This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton. For more information, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu. The U.S. economy has grown stronger, and immediate issues like the fiscal cliff have been addressed. But Wharton's Kent Smetters warns that huge obligations for Medicare and other entitlements could be disastrous if they're not tackled soon. Higher taxes on the rich won't close the funding gap, and the U.S. must face the prospect of raising taxes on the middle class and cutting entitlement benefits.
Hello, I'm Jeff Brown for Knowledge at Wharton. Today we're with Kent Smetters, professor of business economics and public policy at Wharton, and we're going to talk about 2013 and how things stand at the beginning and how we think they're going to go through the year. So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the first thing I think is just a general question. You know, what is the state of the economy? It certainly seems to be a little bit better, but no one's really bragging about it. Is it going to get better or sputter along, get worse? What do you think?
I think it's going to sputter along, and I think we're in this for a while. I think a lot of the projections that people have about a turnaround 2013, 2014 are probably optimistic. So historically, since 1980, fixed private investment has hovered around 16, 17, 18% of GDP. And that's gone way down. It went down to about 10, 11% during the Great Recession. And it's slowly climbing its way up, but it really has not come back to where we need it. And the job market is still really bad. I mean, the job creation is barely keeping up with the growth rate of population. At this rate, we won't be back to the natural rate of unemployment for another 5 years at least. And in fact, most of the changes that we've seen in the unemployment rate recently has actually been just because people dropping out looking for jobs rather than kind of real jobs being created. And so, you know, fundamentally in this country, and this is the big issue that a lot of people aren't talking about, is we really have an education problem. If you look at the unemployment rate for college graduates, it never got that high, even during this Great Recession. It's been a lot of people who do not have a college degree. That's still in the double digits. Blacks and minorities still in the double digits. And so that's the big problem, is that the world's changing. There's big returns to education. A lot of people don't have it. And that's what we really need to be focusing on.
For those who don't have it, I hate to be pessimistic, but is there any real hope other than going back to school? But what if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s and you don't have much education?
Yeah, the truth is that there really is not a lot of hope unless they obtain new skills. And so I think the approach for education is multifaceted. We need to have much better public schools. Public schools should be focused on educating kids and not as employment opportunities. It should be more power to kids and less power to the teacher unions. Of course, there's more issues involved than just that. We're spending a lot per capita on kids in this country in terms of education. We're one of the highest in the world, but we're getting very little return for it. And so we need to get public schools fixed. But we also need to get training better for people in their 30s so they can acquire new skills. But bottom line is a college degree is still the big differentiator in the labor market today.
While we're on public schools for just a second, one of the obvious problems is kids dropping out. They're
right.
Clearly not getting an education. But for those who remain, do you think that the schools are focusing on the right skills, the right subjects?
No, I don't think so. I think there has to still be more reward for getting people to understand a lot of the basic fundamentals of reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean, there's still we have a shortage still of engineers, of even computer science people in this country. And we still have kids who are graduating who really can't comprehend reading and can't write. And these are huge advantages in the labor market.
When you look at the economy, aside from the things we've mentioned, what do you see are sort of the key issues that are kind of overhanging right now that will either push it ahead or could send us back into a bigger slowdown?
Yeah, and I think the education reform is kind of a long-term investment. Other long-term investments that we got to be making right now is entitlement reform. Kind of this belief, this myth out there that we don't have to take any kind of big hits right now until we get the economy back. So it's let's just get the economy back to full employment, and then we'll take our medicine. And that's the big problem that we face right now, because that's just the myth. In particular, we'll never get people to make large investments in this economy when they face tremendous uncertainty if they're going to get taxed to death kind of later on. We really have to resolve the long-term financing problem of the government to encourage people to make kind of the big bets. We've already seen this in the area of biology right now. Investment in that area has gone way down. Lots less of investment in pharma, large molecule, small molecule therapies, and so forth over time because they're long-term bets, and no one knows what that world's going to look like 10 years from now. And given the low probability of success, people are starting to shift toward less risky things. And that's a big problem. The government needs to create much more clarity for investors and people making big sacrifices what that world's going to look like a decade from now. And we're just not doing that.
A lot of the discussion of entitlements, of course, looks at Medicare as the real big one. That's a major, major problem. And you hear remedies proposed like, well, raising the eligibility age a year or two, or clamping down on the payments to doctors and hospitals. Are those really enough, or does have to be something much more sweeping than that to make this work?
It has to be fundamental reform. Those are not going to do much. Increasing the entitlement age or retirement age is not going to do much. Reducing reimbursements to doctors just means fewer doctors are going to take Medicare. And so what really has to change is we need to go in a fundamental reform away from the fee-for-service model that we have now, more toward per capitation or having people understand the marginal costs of the medicine that they are getting. And so various plans out there, bipartisan plans like the Ryan Rivlin plan and the other plans that have tried to move the conversation in that direction, right now have been kind of demagogued by all sides. But that's the conversation that we need to have. If we fix everything else and don't touch Medicare, we're doomed. And if we screw up a lot of things but fix Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, we're in pretty good shape. And so it really comes down to those.
And Social Security, my impression is that's a problem but not as big a problem as Medicare. Is that correct?
It is. It's a much smaller problem both in size and in the nature of the problem. In size, it's probably 1/6 of the problem of Medicare. And in terms of the nature of the problem, at least with Social Security benefits, it's a dollar benefit. So you can decide who to give fewer dollars to. And lots of plans out there about keeping the poor out of poverty, but maybe reducing some of the benefits that go to higher income classes and so forth. And with Medicare, much higher, harder problem, because what do? You say, we're not going to pay for half of this open heart surgery, and you pay for the other half. Much harder problem to fix.
Yeah, and I gather that raising the eligibility age or the starting age for Medicare doesn't mean much because those are the healthier people in their 60s.
Right.
It's the people in their 80s who are really costing a fortune.
That's right. Almost all the Medicare spending, I shouldn't say all, but the vast majority of it, is done in the last 2-3 years of life. And so increasing the eligibility age has very little impact.
Now, looming over all this, of course, is the question of the debt and
right.
deficit and the debt ceiling and all that. How important is it that we get some sort of kind of long-term solution to these problems?
Yeah, it's critical. I mean, no one's going to make an investment. Private entrepreneurs are not going to make the sacrifice until they know what the long run looks like. And the signal so far from Washington has been entrepreneurs and people who've invested and succeeded, they're going to get the ones, they're going to be the ones who we go to for getting the money to solve these problems. And so until you create that type of certainty about what the future politics is going to look like by solving, having us on a long-run sustainable path today, we're not going to make any real headway. I mean, what I think the biggest myth that really just needs to be dealt with is this idea that we can just balance all these problems on kind of the backs of the rich. And that's been the group we've gone to in the past, and that we can just pile it some more on. Right now, we're carrying a national deficit of $9,000 per every U.S. household. If the Bush tax cuts had expired, so the taxes went up for everybody, taxes would have only gone up about $2,000 per household. And that's what everybody was calling the fiscal cliff. and of course, that couldn't possibly happen. And so it's this big view in Washington, really on both sides, that the middle class should not be hit, whether it's higher taxes or lower benefits, that they should be participating in this whole debate, where it's just mathematically impossible to do something meaningful without them participating, either in the form of higher taxes, a broader base, lower benefits. And this, the most recent tax increase on the rich will close about 6 to 7% of the annual deficit this year, trivial amounts. And so we need to have a broad-based discussion.
Is there any way to deal with these problems without a lot of pain for the middle class and for others? Are there any technological breakthroughs or sort of dream solutions that we haven't thought of or that may come along?
No. I mean, we're just way over-consuming right now. We've gotten a very rich appetite, and it's going to be painful for people to think about, I have to cut back. But right now, as a nation, we're spending much more than what we can. And as a result, we're not saving for the future. And we're on a path that is just completely unsustainable. The middle class has to be part of the solution.
I think most people would, if you ask them what they want out of the economy, they want an improved standard of living, better prospects for jobs, and a comfortable retirement. It sort of boils down to those. What are the prospects for getting all of those in the next 10, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, they're not good, at least on our current path, simply because we've already consumed a lot of that. we've saved very little for the future. The average U.S. household has saved very little. Our government has overspent, and we're simply not going to grow fast enough in order to allow us to kind of grow our way out of this problem. Keep in mind, certain benefits like Social Security and Medicare already keep up with lots of the technological progress. They keep up with the average wage rate. And so it's not something that we can easily grow our way out of. And so real fundamental choices are going to have to be made. And this is why it's, I think, real important that we make real hard decisions about saving more today, and why the tone of Washington has to completely change. Right now, the president is essentially taking advantage, I think, of the weakened position that Congress has, especially in the public limelight, whereas the president really needs to shift focus and say, you know, this is a national problem. This is a bipartisan problem. We're here because of both political parties. And here we need to have a fundamental reform to our tax code, our entitlement problems. But this is going to involve everybody's participation. This idea that we can just finance this off the backs of a few is just mathematically impossible.
Well, it's grim, but I guess we knew we had to hear it. So we'll hope things turn out better. But thank you very much. We'll talk about it again.
My pleasure.
Wharton's Mauro Guillen says the U.S. economy is likely to get stronger in 2013, but he expects economic and fiscal troubles to persist in Europe. The world economy could also suffer from the economic slowdown in the major emerging markets in China, India, and Brazil.
Hello, I'm Jeff Brown for Knowledge at Wharton. Today we're with Mauro Guillen, a professor of international management for Wharton, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We want to talk about the state of the economy, the state of the world for 2013. And I'd like to talk about the emerging markets. We often think that this is where the future is. This is where the great growth potential is. At the same time, if you're an investor, you see a lot of volatility, and you know that there are a lot of ups and downs in these countries. What is the state of the emerging markets today?
Well, it's not as good as we would like it to be here in the United States or in Europe or in Japan, in the parts of the world that are not growing that much. And let me explain. I think most people would like the emerging economies right now to become the locomotives of the global economy. But in recent months, over the last year or so, emerging economies have also begun to slow down a little bit. They're still growing. China's growing at 6-7%. India is growing maybe 5%. But Brazil is barely growing. It's growing at less than 1%. So this slowdown in the emerging economies actually comes at a bad point in time. Because we would like them to be a little bit more dynamic than what they are right now.
And is this a result of what's happened in the rest of the world spilling over to them, or do they have their own factors that are causing this?
Well, the answer is yes to both. So the emerging economies, of course, export their manufactured products and some of their energy or other commodities to Europe or to the United States. So if growth here or in Europe is not as strong, then, of course, these economies suffer. But then secondly, they also have problems of their own. Brazil has encountered a number of bottlenecks in its economic development, in its growth over the last 3 or 4 years. Interest rates were too high because they were trying to keep inflation down, but that meant that then local businesses didn't have enough credit at an appropriate price to invest and to create jobs and to grow. India also is famous for many bottlenecks in infrastructure, in the legal system, and so on. So one economy, emerging economy after another, what we see is that both because of domestic reasons and global reasons, international reasons, they're starting to grow less rapidly than they used to.
And China, which was such a powerhouse there for a while. But what is going on in China? It seems to be slowing down.
Well, in China, we've had a leadership transition that is still going on in terms of filling in the various positions in the government. So there's some uncertainty regarding that. Then, of course, we have the problem with their exports to Europe in particular right now, and a little bit also to the United States, even though the U.S. economy is growing faster than European economies, which are not growing at all, except for Germany and a couple of others. And then thirdly, of course, China has the problem of transformation right now. It is an economy that has been investing a lot in infrastructure. It has been growing in terms of exports. But it is an economy that now needs to switch to the creation and the growth of a domestic consumption market. These transformations, these transition phases are difficult. And I think China is now essentially wrestling with those issues.
Now, how does this affect the developed countries? I mean, does this make them more competitive, or is this hurting them? Why should we care other than they're our fellow citizens of the world?
Well, the emerging economies are a very important part of the global economy. They're nearly half of global output, also 40%, at least 40% of the global market for consumer goods. So if things don't go well in the emerging economies, that affects everyone, not just them. 20 years ago, the emerging economies were at most 15 or 20% of the global economy. The bulk of economic activity in the world and the bulk of consumption was in Europe, the United States, and Japan. But that's no longer the case. So now we cannot really afford emerging economies not to play their role in the global economy, which is to grow quickly, right? These are the economies, the up-and-coming economies. They're supposed to grow quickly. They're not growing as quickly as they once did, and that's a problem.
And now you've mentioned the major ones of China, India, Brazil. What about some of the other countries? There are other Asian countries that were once known as real comers. What's happening with them?
Well, we have in the emerging world, we have new countries that have now become hot and attractive for investment, and they're growing quickly. I would mention, for example, in Latin America, there's two of them, Colombia and Peru, clearly doing really well. especially compared to 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. If you go to Africa, there's also two or three economies that are doing better than in the past, even though there are many problems, of course, that continue to limit growth in Africa. In the Middle East, well, we have Turkey, which is doing pretty well. But then right next to it, we have Egypt, which in the wake of the Arab Spring has actually gone through a period of enormous difficulty from an economic and financial point of view for a variety of reasons. And then in Asia, well, we have Pakistan, which is actually doing pretty well. It is growing about the same at the same pace as India. And this is a very large country as well. And in Southeast Asia, we have now Indonesia doing relatively well, and Malaysia, well, which seems to have finally recovered from the difficulties from 10 years ago or so. But we still have other economies like Thailand. We have other economies in the region that are not doing as well. And so it's a mixed bag. It's a mixed picture. Some countries are doing better than we were expecting them to do, and others are not performing as well. But on balance, I would say that we're worse off in terms of emerging growth in the emerging economies than we were 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Now, is there anything that the international community could be doing to make this situation better? Wealthy Western countries or major agencies, the World Bank, organizations like that?
Well, we have way too many question marks in the global economy right now. I mean, just to give you a short list, we have the euro crisis in Europe. It seems as if now is the month of January. It seems as if over the last couple of months, the problem has stabilized a little bit. But that doesn't mean things are going okay in Europe. In fact, we have a recession going on. So there's the double dip recession. The second dip in this recession has been declared as of 6 weeks ago. So we have these very big problems in Europe. And let's not forget that Europe is still 25% of the global market, right? And we have the continuing fiscal crisis in the United States, which is, I think, for the most part, self-inflicted at this point. And we have, of course, Japan, which doesn't seem to be able to find its way out of its own 20-year quasi-recession, right? You know, although the new prime minister seems to be very adamant in that he wants to change things. Let's see what happens. So those are the bigger problems. But if you shift the level of analysis a little bit and you think about the global economic and financial infrastructure, what we have right now is very little collaboration among governments in terms of what should be done. In fact, what we have is governments trying to take advantage of one another. We have all of these currency manipulations going on. China has been for a long time accused of being a currency manipulator, but they're not alone. Over the last year or so, Japan has also tried to reduce the value of the yen so as to remain export competitive. So has Switzerland, right? And so has the United States. In the United States, we have printed a lot of money, and that has put downward pressure on the dollar, and that has made possible a revival of U.S. Manufactured exports. So everybody is, trying to look after their own interests. I see very little collaboration among key governments around the world, and I think this is also something that adds to the uncertainty out there.
Now, if there were to be more collaboration, where's the likely country or organization to lead that?
Well, I think there are three or four, maybe five countries in the world that really matter right now that have a something to say about a possible way out from this big global slowdown that we happen to be trapped into. Certainly, the United States. Certainly, China. Right, those are the two biggest economies, and they are very important from a financial point of view for very different reasons. Then we have Germany, which in my view should perhaps be the representative from Europe, right, as opposed to having the European Union as such. Germany is the world's fourth largest economy, and it is the second most important export power. And then, of course, you have Japan and possibly the UK, right? But that's about it. I mean, I don't think countries such as Mexico or Brazil or Argentina or Colombia or Indonesia or Turkey should be sitting at the table trying to make decisions, because then the table gets too big. We have too many people negotiating. So what I think we need is four or five key countries sitting at the table and helping us overcome all of the complexities that we're facing right now in the global economy.
Now, we also hear about fiscal imbalances, and you can explain a little what that means and why that's a problem.
Well, we have all sorts of imbalances in the world. I mean, you mentioned fiscal, which is government spending more money than what they take into us in the form of revenue taxes for the most part. We also have other kinds of imbalances, financial imbalances. We have trade imbalances and so on and so forth. But focusing on the fiscal imbalances, the problem, of course, is that, as you know, investors no longer believe that some governments in the world can, you know, pay them back. And so what we've seen is interest rates on bonds, government bonds, go through the roof for those countries that have lost the trust of investors. Now, at the other side of the equation, we have other countries that can pretty much borrow at zero interest rates, right? That includes certainly Germany, but also Switzerland, and at least up until now, pretty much also the United States. So these are countries that still are perceived as being solid and being capable of you know, returning the money that they're asking investors to give them. Now, in the U.S., again, I mentioned earlier that most of the fiscal problem is self-inflicted, because the upcoming battle now in the month of February will be the debt ceiling. And, of course, this is an artificial thing, right? And I'm sure there's going to be quite a bit of political fighting about it. But, you know, the global economy and investors know that the U.S. is, at least so far, is a government that can pay its debt, right? Unlike other governments around the world, which cannot right now.
It seems sometimes like the U.S. can get away with murder. You know, I remember, I think it was about 18 months ago when we lost our credit rating, our top rating, and everybody said this will be a catastrophe and interest rates are lower now.
Well, and that was a signal. I think that was a signal to the politicians in Washington, D.C. that they shouldn't do anything crazy, because although the U.S. continues to be the largest economy and it is the most important financial power in the world, its strength is not unlimited, right? But the U.S. has one big advantage, as we all know, which is that the dollar continues to be the most important reserve currency. Like about 70% of all allocated reserves in the world are in dollar-denominated assets. Now, this gives the U.S. Quite a bit of you know, leeway, a lot of breathing room with which to play, because once again, there is a big appetite for U.S.-denominated dollars, and the U.S. can therefore, you know, play, you know, a different role in the global economy than other economies that don't have that kind of a privilege.
And it looks like investors around the world simply don't believe the U.S. will ever default on its debt. Is that what these numbers tell us?
Well, I would never say that we'll never, ever default, because obviously, you know, what is the time horizon here? Is it 20 years, or is it 50 or 100 or 200 years? If history is of any guide, well, I would definitely bet my pension fund right now in saying that the U.S. Will default within the next 500 years, right? Now, I don't think it will default within the next 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, not in the foreseeable future, right? But a lot of it depends also on what happens to China and whether China takes more steps in the direction of playing an active role in global finance. And, of course, a very important element in all of this will be the yuan, what happens to the Chinese currency. Is the Chinese currency going to become, at some point in the near future, another reserve currency? And then once it becomes a reserve currency, of course, I think the prediction is that it will probably become an important reserve currency. I don't think it will displace the dollar, but it will become an important reserve currency, maybe at the same level as the euro, you know, 15-20% of all currency reserves in the world. But we're still at least 5, 7, 10 years away from that. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to, you know, be the most important economy in the world from the financial point of view, and will continue to be or to have the most important reserve currency.
So let's just finish with a sort of a projection for 2013. Do you think that at the end of this year, conditions will look much different from the way they are now, either better or worse?
Well, 12 months down the road, I think if we go region by region, I think things will look much, much better here in the United States, unless, of course, something really weird happens in Washington, D.C. over the next 2 or 3 months regarding all of these fiscal negotiations. Europe, I think, is not going to be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel yet, at the end of this year, 2013. Why? Well, because they seem set on an array of austerity measures, and these austerity measures may at some point be effective, but it's not going to be anytime soon. You know, if that's the way they want to overcome their problems, it's going to take a while, right? And of course, unemployment in the meantime will be very, very high. And then I think the big question mark is where we started this conversation. It's with the emerging economies. The two that worry me the most, India and Brazil, because of their size and because of some of the problems that they're encountering, will they manage to reverse the decline in their growth rates? I think this is a very urgent question, especially in the case of Brazil. So I think emerging economies, hopefully, more likely than not, they will be better off at the end of this year, but certainly not Europe, and hopefully the U.S. will be better off, yeah.
Well, we'll come back in a year and see how it turned out. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
For more business news and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.